Hey, I'm Francis Lam, and this is Splendid Table Selects, our mini podcast about the stuff that makes us better cooks and eaters. You know, most of the time when we talk about healthy eating, the conversation goes straight below the neck. It's usually around things like heart health or cholesterol or managing diabetes, you know, that kind of thing. But some doctors believe that we should actually be focused on feeding what's in our heads, our brains. Dr. Drew Ramsey calls himself a nutritional psychiatrist. He's a researcher on the connection between food, brain function, and mental health at Columbia University. And he's a farmer, too. Our contributor Shauna Seaver spoke with Dr. Ramsey in New York City. Have a listen.
Hi, Dr. Ramsey. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So when you get a new patient in your practice who's struggling with their mental health, say depression or anxiety, what are some of the questions that you seek to answer in those initial meetings with them?
When I meet a new patient, I do a general psychiatric interview, like all psychiatrists. And in addition to that, I really want to pay attention, as many of us do, to the lifestyle factors that influence my patient's mental health. And those include food. And in food, we do a very sort of detailed walk through your day as an eater. It's kind of simple. I call it a simple food assessment. Just really trying in broad brushstrokes to understand what's your relationship with food, what are the main foods you eat, and the part that often gets missed, and it's very important for nutritional psychiatry evaluation, is where is your motivation? And what are your personal goals with food? We have a lot of ideas in medicine that we're going to tell people what to do. And behaviorally, that doesn't really work as much as partnering with people and asking them around their motivation and their goals. And of course, trying to influence those. We look at what's missing. And there are certain food categories that most Americans are struggling with and most of our patients are struggling with. Things like seafood. The average American eats 14 pounds of seafood per year, and it's probably not the best seafoods for your brain, which are going to be more of the smaller fish, fish that have high amounts of DHA and other long-chain omega-3 fats, like anchovies, for example. Great brain food. Another food category is leafy greens. Great food category that a lot of people, you know, how many options do you have in your house? You have a couple salads, but to really think about those is a critical base of the diet because they're so nutrient-dense. They have all these important brain nutrients, things like folate and calcium. And of course, with all this new science about how the gut influences our mental health, eating more plants, one of the benefits of that is you're getting more of these fibers that healthy bacteria in our gut.
Now, is the goal to get patients off antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications and use food as medicine?
You know, I'm in the service business, and so I try to serve my patients' needs. I believe lots of people need to be on antidepressants, and they're very, very effective medications for certain individuals, and I've seen that in my practice. I think a lot of times where my work in nutritional psychiatry gets misinterpreted and interpreted in almost a dangerous way is the idea that all of our mental health problems and symptoms can be fixed simply by eating more of this food or that food. Mm-hmm. There are certain foods that the human frame and the human mind have always done well on. We're really missing most of those in our modern American diet. And weaving those back in involves some challenges for us.
And a lot of what you talk about, and I'm hearing you say that you're focusing on adding foods rather than eliminating foods from the diet. So you've talked about the leafy greens.
Yes. I think it's just such a tragedy that there's been such an invoking of food fear. It started with cholesterol and fat to really, you know, rather ridiculous notions when it comes to how a population should think about food. And I really love the idea that as physicians, as a healthcare system, we want to promote healthy lifestyle. And we do that by leading by example, by giving people really practical choices and by being our partners with our patients. I don't want to shake my finger about the fact you eat a cupcake. I want to talk about all the exciting ways that you're incorporating plants into your diet or that you're at least trying seafood because you don't like it. Those to me feel like really critical clinical conversations that you know we're seeing much more of.
So you've talked about the leafy greens, the seafoods. I also know that you talk a lot about beans as being important foods. What about those are beneficial for the brain?
Nuts and beans are just good examples of, first of all, foods that fit everybody's budget. That one of the critiques of the food movement is that this is kale and wild blueberries and this is expensive stuff. And so with beans and nuts, you get a very, very nice price point. nuts are great because they're a nice mix of a good fat, a fat that everybody agrees is healthy for us, monounsaturated fat, same fat that's in olive oil. And nuts have a lot of minerality. Also things like almonds, there are some special nutrients you don't find a lot of places, like vitamin E. And you find a lot of vitamin E in almonds. So nuts make a great snack. That's one of our interventions at the clinic. We work with a lot of snackers, and grabbing a handful of nuts is a nice way, again, not to bump the blood sugar, but get some nice slow-burning carbs, some proteins, some fats, and some good brain nutrients. Beans, lentils, black beans, red beans, just great brain foods. Actually, the small red bean has more antioxidant capacity than almost any other food, according to the USDA. You know, people aren't saying red beans are like, you know, a superfood, but like they really are. And again, with this movement we have towards more plants, a lot of families struggle with that. Well, what does that mean? How do you get protein in a meal like that? How do I get a filling meal? Beans are a great example of something that's quite accessible to most folks and a nice way to get a plant-forward or vegetarian meal in there every now and then.
And what's so special about fermented foods? Because these are foods that are actually having a moment, quite trendy, but it's good to hear that they're good for our brain as well.
Yeah, let me sip on my kombucha as I answer this question. Hold on. So fermented foods are fascinating and captivating in us and having a moment for a number of reasons. First, this is the way that all cultures have always stored food, that the easily accessible sugars get digested by bacteria and create things like yogurt or kefir or kombucha. And the interesting thing, one is those bugs, and I called these the good bugs, one of what I feel are some of the essential ingredients to a healthy human brain. And the good bugs, one, they have this critical role in our inflammatory system. Everybody's heard this buzzword inflammation that's sort of running around everywhere in medicine, and we're trying to cool off inflammation. And even with depression, dementia, this has really become a way that we increasingly think about those diseases. And so if you think about cooling off inflammation, where it comes from, one spot is looking at what's called dysbiosis, where people have different types of bacteria living in their intestine and have, you can imagine, it's kind of like a zoo down there. And you've got some animals in the zoo that are very like peaceful, they calm down inflammation, and you know, then you can have some animals in your zoo that are causing some problems. There's a tremendous series of communications between the gut and the brain. There's this giant nerve, the vagus nerve, that wanders down from the brain and listens to the gut. And so fermented foods give us some nutrients that you don't find many places, like vitamin K2. They help us populate the gut with healthy bacteria and help us maintain diversity in our bacteria. And, you know, it's one of those kind of common sense rules that those are foods that have really been around the planet for a long time. We've co-evolved with them. So adding some of that into your diet, we feel, is one of those moves that helps people eat in a more brain healthy type pattern.
Now, I know some people are wondering, why can't I just take supplements? What's the difference between taking supplements and eating whole foods in terms of brain health?
Before we get into the science of that, let me just answer as an eater and ask listeners to think about this. When was the last time you went over and had a really nice time, nice laugh, making a nice meal of supplements and serving them to your friends and family? I think that to me is the first difference, that supplements give us this idea that there's a way for us to access health without engaging in our food and in our food system, and that is false. There is no insurance for us not having a healthy food system, and there is no insurance for us not eating the foods that we were made to eat. And unfortunately, that's where we are right now. I hear this a lot, where there's a lot of push of supplements, especially as it's been this really side effect of Instagram and of social media and of all these algorithms, that the amount of information, I'd say misinformation, that people get about what they need to be healthy is just shocking. The algorithms find you, they generate fear, and they sell you supplements. Before 1912, we didn't know what a single vitamin was. There was a lot of human creativity, human happiness, human love before 1912. And so I think that certainly in some situations, we need supplements. I take a little vitamin D in the winter when I get low. If I'm feeling a little down, I haven't eaten seafood for whatever reason, maybe I'll take a high-grade omega-3 supplement. But looking as the supplement to be the foundation of our health has just never made sense to me. And the data of that, I mean, what is most highly correlated with taking a multivitamin if you're a woman over the age of, I think it's 50? It's your risk of death. I mean, it's the data on supplements is really, if you look into it, It's a very deregulated industry, generally full of all kinds of strange things that people depend on for their health, as opposed to, you know, more evidence-guided or evidence-based treatments, or just good common sense simple treatments like food.
You are an avid farmer. You have a farm in Indiana. That's your roots. That's where you're from. And a lot of times in your work, you often talk about the role that food plays beyond just the eating of it. You talk about the sourcing, the preparing, the sharing of it, the non-nutritive aspects of brain food as being just as important for our mental health and in general well-being, which I find really fascinating.
Shane, I thought you said aphid farmer, and I just got this state of panic that my kale patch is getting eaten while we were talking here.
Avid farmer. I love this idea of connection over food as being a good part of us feeling well and enjoying life.
There's a really simple lesson in biology that structure equals function. And the structure of our brain is one of connection. And when I think about when I evaluate someone, I'm looking at their mental health. I think about what are the connections in their lives? How have they formed those connections? How do they maintain those connections? And I think about that as a real evidence of a brain that's more connected. And so there are all these non-nutrient ways that we can think about our mental health and the mental health of our community that revolve around food. What I like about that, first of all, is people are much more interested in talking about food than they are talking right away about mental health, although thank goodness that's changing a little bit. But it's a way of really thinking about these other non-nutrient or non-nutritive factors. Sourcing of your food is, just imagine the experience of going to your farmer's market, having that community experience that's so critical to our mental health. And think about the way that all and so much about our community revolves around food. We bump into our friends at the grocery store, at the farmer's market, and seeing folks who grow your food, shaking their hand, maybe even paying a little bit more for it. Those are ways that I think we can use food to really build resilience in our mental health. I think it's one of the ways that we can, there are a lot of things we need to do to defeat the mental health epidemic. And I want everybody to be clear. I think food's a part of that. I don't think you can just eat a certain way and have optimal mental health. I spend a lot of time with people doing psychotherapy. I prescribe a lot of different types of medications to patients as responsibly and effectively as I can. But food is certainly a part of the picture.
Well, we know on the show time and again, we talk about food as being this universal conversation. I mean, you could meet a complete stranger and strike up a conversation about how you eat and what you like to eat. And it almost seems like talking about brain food is a really simple way to destigmatize mental illness, if you know, talking about feeding the brain as opposed to what's wrong with your brain. You know, do you find this to be true or an easy sort of entry point in talking to new patients or talking to other people about mental illness?
I certainly do. A couple of years ago, as I was giving more public speeches about food, I sort of promised myself that I'd use the word suicide and use the word depression in every talk. I was really nervous about that back then. And what I found is that everybody meets my gaze in those moments, that everybody knows what we're talking about. Everybody's having this conversation, is concerned about their mental health. So I do believe it's a way for us to start thinking about mental health as brain health, that we're feeding your brain. And as we think about brain health and what we can all do to improve our brain health and improve our emotional health, I feel that we begin to take on the mental health epidemic together. And that's really the only way that we're going to defeat it, is if we talk about these conditions, if we properly diagnose them and properly treat them. And I believe this new part is we empower patients. One of the things I like about food is the fun that it brings into the clinical room for me. I mean, it's really a gas to hear about what people eat, how they eat, their favorite foods, the little habits they don't tell people. And then it's such an intimate way to know someone and influence them, to partner with them and think about, you know, really how they nourish themselves in the most granular way, what they eat.
Now, I know, talking a little bit about the future here, the future of mental health, if getting enough brain food, you know, if we know that can improve our mental health as adults, decrease depression and anxiety, how do you feel about eating these foods as a preventative measure? I mean, I have children. I know you're a parent. Do you think about that when you're feeding your kids almost as a way of sort of warding off mental illness starting at a young age?
Well, the first thing is I think the evidence body is growing, that it's an idea right now. And there's some evidence. Evidence-based medicine is we're constantly adding to the evidence base. So there's the treatment side. Does it help improve treatment? If when I start Prozac, I also really do a detailed dietary analysis and help someone change their food. There are a couple of studies that suggest it can help. Prevention is really where we can have the largest impact in terms of mental health. Depression will be the largest cause of disability in America and worldwide starting next year in 2020. And when you think about, you know, that's an illness then that's really coming for all of us, coming for our families and our kids. What do we do about it? How do we help patients before they meet me? How do I help you before you have a mental health symptom? And so then we get into these ideas around lifestyle factors and can we feed our kids in a way that prevents mental health problems? Can we, and I think the downside of this and I guess the caution in it, the underbelly of it that many people, smart folks in my field are concerned about is we don't want parents who don't feed their kids, right? Or let's say you have a kid who does a very picky eater feeling like, oh gosh, you caused the bipolar disorder because you didn't feed your child salmon. Like that, right. That, you know, mental health disorders are a mix of genetics and environment. And when you look at what environmental factors we have the most control over, for sure it's our food. Maybe it doesn't feel that way all the time, but you really do. You decide what goes on the end of your fork. I think it's one of the most powerful ways that we can intervene with our children's brain health. There are a lot of complex genetics in terms of our mental health and what happens. And again, I hope that people approach this from an attitude of loving kindness, that we're all doing our best to improve our mental health and making food choices that, according to our values, beliefs, and as much evidence as is out there, suggest that we are doing our best. So do I intentionally feed my kids with a hope that it helps their mental health? Of course I do. Just like all parents listening make decisions about their children's food that we hope is the best for them. And I talk to my kids about it. One of the things I like is it also opens up a question where I feed my kids almonds and say, these have a ton of vitamin E, sweetie. These are really good for your brain. And I'll tell them a little bit about that. You know, one of the things we all know as parents, like simple nutritional psychiatry, what happens to your children when they don't eat lunch? And you see that instant shift, right, where there's a profound effect in terms of food and our mental state.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ramsey.
My pleasure. Remember to eat your leafy greens and seafood, everyone.
Thank you.
That was our contributor, Shauna Seaver, with Dr. Drew Ramsey, a psychiatrist and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. You can learn more about Dr. Ramsey by going to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out some of the recipes he shared for maximizing good brain health. In honor of Mental Health Awareness Month, this story is part of a larger collaborative partnership with our colleagues at Call to Mind, an initiative from American Public Media to foster new conversations about mental health. And listen to our next episode of The Splendid Table. It'll be in your podcast queue May 17th. And we're spending the hour exploring issues around food and mental health. It features conversations with Chef Dave McMillan about substance use and recovery in the restaurant world. Activist Virgie Tovar talks to us about fat discrimination, shame, and body image. And we'll hear from playwright and screenwriter Stephanie Covington Armstrong about her very personal experience with an eating disorder. To learn more, head to our website, splendidtable.org. That's it for today. I'm Francis Lamb, and thank you for listening.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.